Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome again to Symmetry of Soul, a virtual study group for students of the Urantia book, and all of you who are listening who might be interested in the teachings of Fifth Epochal Revelation. I'm Ann Garner. I'm here with my co-hosts, Dr. Chris Halverson, James Woodward, and Kermit Anderson. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ann. Hello there, Reverb James, and hello, Kermit.
Hey, James.
Hey, I was pretty quick on hitting that mute, but a little bit of it came through. Nice to be here. Thanks for busting me there, Chris.
No problem.
Howdy, Ann, Kermit.
Hello, Kermit.
Howdy, howdy, everybody. James and Chris and Ann and chat room folks. Last week, we completed part three of our series on the third epical revelation to Urantia. When we began with section four in paper 93, the Salem religion. It was simple, consisting of three precepts: one God, divine favor of God through faith, and obedience to the seven commandments of Melchizedek. Yet this idea of getting divine favor for nothing by faith was too advanced for people of those days. We had a wide-ranging discussion about the fact that Melchizedek's gospel of divine favor by faith was so hard for people of those days to grasp, and that religionists of faith today find it so difficult to move their faith to trust in God's watch care, let alone those today who still find salvation by faith still too difficult to grasp. Melchizedek attempted to substitute a sacrament of bread and wine for sacrifices and burnt offerings, and did not permit sacrifices within the Salem colony, albeit the various tribes maintain auxiliary centers on the outskirts of Salem where they offered sacrifices and burnt offerings. Machaventa did not attempt to reform the mores or habits of the world, but attended strictly to the fulfillment of his two-pronged mission to keep alive the truth of the one God and to prepare the way for Michael's bestowal. We reflected on the similarities of the third epical revelation and the fourth epical revelation in that neither attempted social, political, or economic reforms. The fifth epical revelation, however, does challenge its devotees to confront and reform their preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices. We are further challenged in our efforts to spread the good news to work at cultivating our discernment for our fellows' real needs. If they are devoid of faith, then we can begin with the simple truth of the existence of one God accessible via childlike faith, that is, the truths of the third epical revelation. If they are grounded in a faith, then we encourage trust in the Father's love and service for our fellows, the truths of the fourth epical revelation. Discernment of one's real spiritual needs should precede our introduction of the fifth epical revelation to anyone. In section 5, the selection of Abraham, geography and genetics were of primary importance in the choice of Palestine for the location of Melchizedek's mission. Palestine was centrally located with respect to the main trade and travel routes of the civilized world. Also, the Melchizedeks were confident that the ancestors of Abraham could be expected to bring forth individuals of intelligence, initiative, sagacity, and sincerity with the requisite endowments to carry the mantle of Melchizedek's revelation. The revelators here provide the coordination of essential knowledge in recounting the events surrounding the selection of Abraham as an individual chosen to provide the material and spiritual leadership sufficient to produce for the conditions suitable for subsequent coming of Jesus to the Hebrews. The serious student will find the work of the revelators most remarkable in their presentation of the events so confusingly referred to in the chapters in Genesis devoted to these happenings. In a few pages, the absurdities and silliness of the Old Testament stories about Lot, his wife, Sodom and Gomorrah are dispatched with a decidedly more logical narrative. In section 6, Melchizedek's covenant with Abraham. Upon formalization of his covenant with Abraham, Melchizedek was told the story of the future occupation of Canaan by his offspring after their sojourn in Egypt, an event several centuries in the future. This foreknowledge of Melchizedek was noted and likened to child's play when compared to the work of the life carriers and their configuration of single-cell organisms to evolve into complex life forms hundreds of millions of years hence. This covenant represents the great Urantian agreement between divinity and humanity, whereby God agrees to do everything and man only agrees to believe God's promises and follow his instructions. A peculiar note was the narration concerning the three celestial beings who appeared to Abraham. We speculated that these three beings might well have been three of the Melchizedek receivers, even that they could be the named Melchizedeks in the Revelation, that is, men of Andat, Malavatia, and Mantusha. This section ends with a brief summary of some of Abraham's accomplishments in honoring his covenant with Melchizedek. Abraham possessed enough spiritual idealism balanced with his material pragmatism to serve as a worthy choice for the promulgation of Melchizedek's mission to Urantia. We're also reminded that those days were pre-Pentecost. The Spirit of Truth had not come, and neither were adjusters universally bestowed. We had a lengthy discussion concerning the questions of what constitutes a supreme decision versus the supreme decision, which leads to the receiving of a pair of personal guardian angels and a thought adjuster. Are there any other issues on last week's program that anyone would like to bring up?
Just one little quick thing. When you were telling about the story of future occupation of Canaan after the sojourn in Egypt, you just misspoke, and you meant to say Abraham was told rather than Melchizedek was told. Yeah.
Right. But, yeah, thank you. Melchizedek did the telling.
Yes, exactly.
And I do, marvelous review, Kermit, and I was thinking about your comments about Genesis, and I thought, oh, that's a little strong, and then I remembered how the Revelators referred to it. That's what we read last week.
Sometimes they call a spade a spade.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
It's pretty strong.
Well, you know, this covenant, it really deserves a little bit of attention. Well, it deserved a lot of attention, being the core of this revelation that we're talking about, just the agreement, you know. God agrees to do everything, man only agrees to believe. It had quite an impact on the world's religion. As the missionaries go out, we're going to talk about them a little later tonight, but I was also thinking about Jesus in his fourth epical revelation. He was in Alexandria with his Indian friends traveling around, and they went to the library. They went to the great library in Alexandria. This was before it was destroyed, and they were talking about all the world religions. I'll read this little part here. This is in part four on page 1432 and paper 130 on the way to Rome. In this library, Gannett saw the largest collection of Indian literature in all the world, and they spent some time here each day throughout their stay in Alexandria. Jesus told Gannett about the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek at this place, and they discussed again and again all the religions of the world. Jesus endeavoring to point out to this young mind the truth in each, always adding, but Yahweh is the God developed from the revelations of Melchizedek and the covenant of Abraham. The Jews were the offspring of Abraham and subsequently occupied the very land wherein Melchizedek had lived and taught, and from which he sent teachers to all the world. And their religion eventually portrayed a clearer recognition of the Lord God of Israel as the universal Father in heaven than any other world religion. So we got the Creator Son giving a pretty nice little shout out to his predecessor, Machaventa, as they're looking through these world religions. I like that.
Yeah, shades of what we'll read about later tonight, minister after the order.
Yes.
Yeah.
Indeed. Well, as Kermit pointed out in his review, we still struggle with these words that God agrees to do everything. Man only agrees to believe God's promises and follow his instructions. And I had some conversations this week, and boy, I tell you, people who read the Urantia book, they still have a great struggle with that by faith.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about regarding that is how even down today, like you say, Ann, we're still having trouble with this. And I'm reminded that, you know, the Adamic gift was intended to not only biologically uplift, but spiritually enhance mankind's receptivity and receptivity for spiritual things. And I'm just wondering if this Adamic deficiency isn't part of what's sort of dogging our steps here as we struggle with this salvation or divine favor by faith, that our mechanisms are still somewhat tardy in development.
Yeah, I mean the lack of Adamic uplift definitely makes that process less innate. You know, you might even say automatic. That you're functioning at a more self-evident level of such things. But, your personality has no limitations on its, its over-control. At least in, as long as there's a potential. And when it comes to this basic core element, if you're human, this potential is there. Even without the Adamic uplift, this potential, the ability to have this insight, to have this simple, pure, initiating relationship with God, and that's there, and you can choose it by faith. That choice is not, diminished by the absence of Adamic uplift. Mm. This speaks more to. It's sad to record that so few persons take delight in cultivating. It doesn't say. It's sad to record that so few persons can. Take delight in cultivating, that they're incapable.
Yeah.
We could, if we only would, know these things.
Yeah.
And, it is a very key paragraph. I mean, the fact that it has three italicized words in it ought to, get your initial attention. And like you said, understands some of these issues like God agrees to do everything. That basic refuting of works righteousness. But you have to understand what that means. I mean, he doesn't agree to tie your shoes. What do they mean by do everything? It's in the sense that he agrees to do all those things that only a creator being can do. We're not creators. We're merely creatures. And we can't create anything in a literal sense. You say, well, I could create a situation where there's love where there wasn't before. Well, you could speak of it that way, but there's only one source of love, and it's not me or any other human on this planet. You know, it's God the Father. You know, I can choose to supply the favorable conditions to allow God's love to flow through me to others. That I'm not creating the love. I'm not even creating, you know, the mechanism. I'm just opening the gate in that mechanism that I do have control over. I can prevent the love from flowing through me.
Mm.
So, you know, that's, you know, that there's a humility. You know, if you don't approach these issues with humility, you know, you immediately are confused just by the first thing. God agrees to do everything, huh? You know, the man only agrees to believe God's promises. Start with that one. Well, you're not going to agree to believe God's promises if you don't trust God. You know, if you merely have faith, I mean, by faith alone you initiate this, you know, but just to reflect that to have an integrous belief, you know, in God, so that you, without qualification, agree to believe God's promises, that requires a living faith. That requires trust. You know, and to follow His instructions. Well, if you haven't taken delight in cultivating the kind of happiness that results from consecrating your life to the moral integrity of the cosmos, you know, like I, you know, just commented during the broadcast last time, you know, follow His instructions. I don't trust authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the knee-jerk reaction that, you know, we have more and more. We've always had to some degree. So, I mean, there's a lot there. Guys, have other thoughts?
Yeah, tremendous clarification there. And as I was thinking it through, as you said that you read that, and I'm so glad you pointed that out about what does it really mean that God agrees to do everything. Because a lot of people still walk in that space of the dichotomy, you might say, of well, I have faith, but I have to do so many things to feel like I'm worthy to survive. I mean, I just heard that just within the last few days, and I was, and these are a couple of longtime students of the Urantia book, and or I've got to make sure I get the people to, I got to work on more people to know how wonderful it is to know the revelation. But see, that goes back to what you said. So few go inward, and it's sad to record. There is more of an outward expression rather than going within and creating and delighting in cultivating what it takes to know how to press.
God
forward.
Doesn't agree to do your outer life.
Yes.
But He does agree that if you open the door, He will fill your inner life to the brim.
Mm, for sure.
Man cannot cause growth. But God can. All man can do is supply the favorable conditions.
Important.
You know, that growth, that's the everything.
That is so important, what you just said right there. Now, we've said it over and over. We cannot cause ourselves to grow, but we can supply the favorable conditions to be grown.
Right.
And that takes and that's where Jesus said, "My yoke is easy, my burden is light."
The doorway to the favorable conditions, humility. If you could cause growth, you would be a creator being. Is that what you believe? You really want to set yourself up as personalized deity, as God? Only God creates. And, another way that you people often, especially historically in Christianity, let's say, misinterpret God agrees to do everything. It's because they still believe in a magical God. And so, many fall into that mode where, literally they think God is going to tie their shoes for them too. Because he's magic. He not only can do everything, he does everything. He does good, he does bad, he does everything. And that, of course, is just fraught with all kinds of difficulty in going down that path. And, that's why I stressed, thinking about agrees to believe God's promises, what's behind such a belief, that it's trust. So that you have those two key components of the third epical revelation, trust and faith.
Yes.
And if you don't have those two, you will have a pair of words. Religionists always have had a pair of words that substitutes for trust and faith. They're magic and fear. Magic is the substitute for trust. And fear is what faith is struggling against. Religions of fear are religions of magic and fear, rather than the religion of Salem, trust and faith.
And we have a question in the chat room at the end of that sentence that I was reading. A man only agrees to believe God's promises and follow his instructions. So someone asked, but how do we know that those quote-unquote instructions are really from God? Would be a response by many. It's often a matter, isn't it, of how much we trust the messenger.
You don't want to just merely trust any messenger. You want to take the light in cultivating, having the insight to refute messengers.
I'm going to ask this person. I sort of interpreted the way he put, he kept all caps from God, messenger, all caps. Perhaps he's meaning God right there, but he'll have to clarify.
Right. There's two things. I'm going to get to that too. But first of all, if it's an external messenger, even if it's the book that you may be holding in your hand right now called the Urantia book, don't just trust it blindly. Engage it, attempt to refute it, find it's not refutable, and therefore believe. Discover it to be true. But then that whole issue of an internal voice, it's one of the reasons why the revelation is here, and sections like conversion and mysticism, they speak to these troubling internal issues. You want to be very, very cautious about believing a voice in your head.
Yeah.
And they say, basically it's better to reject those voices than to believe that it's the adjuster.
Strong warning there.
It's not indispensable. Yeah. The words are not indispensable to your salvation or your life, or to follow a delusion is much worse than to err on the side of caution and running with what you think are God's instructions that you just heard in a quiet moment or in a dream.
Yeah, that's why we get so much instruction to learn to socialize our religious impulses, and that in socializing, you know, the mutual edification of believers has a corrective effect on our path. If we're being led astray or following our own solitary voice, if we will socialize some of those impulses, we can often, with trusted and worthy comrades, be prevented or dissuaded from dangerous paths.
Yeah, and if you've begun the effort of taking delight in cultivating, you get a ways down that path of becoming more attuned to the cosmos, having purer, a greater insight, you can refute those words that you hear in your head if they're false. But like I said, I mean, you know, until you get to the point where you have come to recognize that you have the ability to clearly penetrate such issues of truth and falsehood, it's best to just let it be than to follow a mirage in your mind.
Yeah, and we're even admonished, or we're told of the danger sometimes of a true spiritual message, true spiritual leading, so blinding somebody that it's too much light, too much that the subject is not equipped really to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's that issue too, that you may actually have gotten a little contact with your adjuster, but you hadn't taken delight in cultivating having the integrity to handle that, and he blew all your circuitry. Then you're off following illusions again because you totally twisted the contact.
Yeah. You get half of it.
Right.
For those who are, you know, not longtime listeners, I wanted to make a little clarification. Well, just to point out that when we're talking about this taking delight, which we refer to quite often, Chris does especially, he's referring to these three cosmic intuitions of the cosmic mind that we find outlined on page 192, the causation, duty, and worship. And at the about in the middle of the page there on 192, this is paper 16, by the way, it says, "But it is sad to record that so few persons on Urantia take delight in cultivating these qualities of courageous and independent cosmic thinking." So we do quote those, all of us actually, quite often, but just a little note there. So if you wonder what we're talking about, that's where you find it.
Good one, James.
Yeah. Okay, so we begin now with this week's study.
Excellent. Well, we are. Let's take off here. That was a nice, great review, by the way, Kermit. Great review and good little back glance there into the covenant and some touching on some really meaningful things here. I like this. We're going to pick up our reading in paper 93. Which is titled Machaventa Melchizedek. And we're picking up in section 7 on page 1021. Section 7, the Melchizedek Missionaries. Melchizedek continued for some years to instruct his students and to train the Salem missionaries, who penetrated to all the surrounding tribes, especially to Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Asia Minor. And as the decades passed, these teachers journeyed farther and farther from Salem, carrying with them Makaventa's gospel of belief and faith in God. These descendants of Adamson, the descendants of Adamson, clustered about the shores of the Lake of Van, were willing listeners to the Hittite teachers of the Salem cult. From this one-time Andite center, teachers were dispatched to the remote regions of both Europe and Asia. Salem missionaries penetrated all Europe, even to the British Isles. One group went by way of the Faroes to the Andonites of Iceland, while another traversed China and reached the Japanese of the Eastern Islands. The lives and experiences of the men and women who ventured forth from Salem, Mesopotamia, and Lake Van to enlighten the tribes of the Eastern Hemisphere present a heroic chapter in the annals of the human race. So, man, these guys did get around. They had the Makaventa lit the fire under their tails, did he not?
Yeah,
well, all the way
good
to
example
Iceland.
Of the sixth adjutant there, a little zeal.
Yeah.
Yeah, zeal. Man, British Isles and all the way to Japan. That's,
well, Iceland to Japan.
Oh, yeah, Iceland even, yes. Whoa.
That's
yeah.
the one that
yeah.
I had forgotten about, that they made it to Iceland. That's just amazing.
You're going to say something, Kermit?
Well, no, I was just the last sentence there. These experiences of these missionaries is a whole fertile field for a lot of historical fiction. There's some great tales that you could come up with to tell those stories.
Yeah, no kidding. The whole of the Eastern Hemisphere's geography is your oyster in telling the stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Heroic voyages, you know, setting off from Scotland and getting to the Faroe Islands and making it to Iceland and et cetera.
Yeah. You can stir up the zeal of the young with tales like that.
Ah, movie in the making. Said it in that time frame, too. That really would blow people away. And
I see a trilogy myself.
Yes.
I see a role-playing game in the process here.
Yeah, you know, it just occurred to me, too, like you were saying, James, for those who aren't intimately familiar with all the geographic details and whatnot, when they suddenly, seemingly out of the blue, invoke the descendants of Adamson, clustered around Lake Van, you know, that's tied to the first paragraph, when they say that they went to Asia Minor. In other words, they went up, you know, towards Turkey and Lake Van up there. So that's why they, for those who don't appreciate, that's why they're bringing them in, and the Hittites that were up in that neck of the woods in the days of Abraham. So that you know, they're just pointing out that it was you know, so they went southwest into Egypt and, you know, east basically into Mesopotamia, and then north in Asia Minor, and then from Asia Minor they went up into Europe and the rest of Asia.
Yeah, and all the way across Asia, even to the Japanese islands. You know, that's making some movement. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you had the Silk Road, you know.
Yeah.
Forever it's been there. So.
Well, it's amazing where they fill in these cultural missing links, you know, if you will, on this migrations, you know, bringing in Adamson, Hittites. You know, we've got some scattered information, historical, about these groups, but nothing like the Urantia book that ties them all together and makes sense out of all these migrations and the races.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if it doesn't literally, you know, explain where a particular group of people came from, you can put the pieces together and deduce it. from what they do give you directly. So yeah, it it allows you to just really throw back the veil of confusion on the history of peoples.
But the task was so great and the tribes were so backward that the results were vague and indefinite. From one generation to another, the Salem Gospel found lodgment here and there, but except in Palestine, never was the idea of one God able to claim the continued allegiance of a whole tribe or race. Long before the coming of Jesus, the teachings of the early Salem missionaries had become generally submerged in the older and more universal superstitions and beliefs. The original Melchizedek Gospel had been almost wholly absorbed in the beliefs in the Great Mother, the Son, and other ancient cults.
Quiz question.
After we just tell about you know how great they were and how far they went, well, they kind of poke a hole in that balloon, let some air out of it.
But those seeds were still there.
Yeah, the heroism was still there, even if there were deceivers before.
Chris,
yeah,
did you just
quiz.
Say we have a, oh no, quiz.
Yeah. So the Great Mother, what originated that? You know, still to this day, strong belief system. Where did that originate? The quote unquote, you know, Great Mother. You guys remember?
Is that from Eve, the cult, mother cult?
Yeah, the mother cult. Why is it from Eve? You remember that little detail? The descendants
on,
of Cain.
Oh, yeah.
Remember,
yeah,
it's coming
yeah.
from the descendants
sure.
of Cain.
Oh,
sure.
Okay.
Cain only has Eve. You know, not
sure.
Adam for a parent. And so from Cain's descendants, there was this fixation on one parent over the other and started the whole mother cult.
All right.
You get half credit on that, James.
Okay. So let me
right,
give a
I'll
reference. Let me give the reference to that, one reference. Paper 80. Section 7, paragraph 7, and this is page 895. It was during this age in Crete that the mother cult of the descendants of Cain attained its greatest vogue. This cult glorified Eve in the worship of the Great Mother. Images of Eve were everywhere. Thousands of public shrines were erected throughout Crete and Asia Minor. And this mother cult persisted on down to the times of Christ, becoming later incorporated in the early Christian religion under the guise of glorification and worship of Mary, the earth mother of Jesus. Incredible paragraph there. So thank you for the question, Chris. And all right, good answers.
And your response there by reading that. That passage, that's not controversial or anything.
Not at all.
You think the things about, that we were referring to before, like Sodom and Gomorrah and whatnot, you know, and just, you know, hacking into that, yeah, giant can of worms there.
Woo!
You who today enjoy the advantages of the art of printing little understand how difficult it was to perpetuate truth during these earlier times. How easy it was to lose sight of a new doctrine from one generation to another. There was always a tendency for the new doctrine to become absorbed into the older body of religious teachings and magical practice. A new revelation is always contaminated by the older evolutionary beliefs. Now there's a controversial comment.
I want to read a, speaking of comments, marvelous comment in the chat room from while we were doing that little quiz, you, Chris, and I read that paragraph. Wow. And this is a person I believe, yeah, I think I know who this is, has a strong biblical background. Wow, now I know something I didn't even know I didn't know. Makes sense. That's great. That's a classic.
Yeah, and a new revelation is always contaminated, like you were saying, James, there, that last sentence. Even with the art of printing, and a revelation in printed form.
Yes.
Preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices will rule the day unless you choose otherwise.
Yeah.
You better give that that reference page. There's another one that that you hear quite a bit here on Symmetry of Soul.
You want to grab that one too, Ann?
I'm sorry. I was actually reading here. I was reading on. See, I got to be careful because which one? That's the problem about grabbing a quote. Then I kept reading. So see, that's that. So which one?
That would be paper 109. I don't have the page number, but I have the paper 109. Section 5, paragraph 3.
That's correct. That's on page 1199.
Yeah, relation of adjusters to universe creatures.
Oh, okay.
And the material handicaps of adjuster indwelling.
Yeah.
And don't keep reading, Kermit, like I did.
that speaks to you know, the man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions. Favorable conditions for adjuster indwelling. If you haven't cleared the way of all your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, anything that the adjuster might say will just sound to your ears like an affirmation of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices.
Boy, right. That's a good one right there, Chris. Okay, say
he can't
that
speak
in.
Through those. I mean, he can't penetrate those. Doesn't matter how loud he talks. All you'll hear is, I knew my thoughts were innately divine. That's the only voice you'll hear is affirmation.
Wow.
I mean, because you have free will. The adjuster does. The adjuster can't overrule your free will grip on your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. You know, what does it say about the adjuster? It's subservient to your will.
Yeah.
So you're holding those things, and the thought form that the adjuster sends down just acts like a hammer on that diaphragm of mind forms and just rings them in your mind, and you seem to get a validation of everything you've always believed. That's
that
all you'll hear.
What a lesson to continue to learn and to focus on when we said, well, and I've heard myself say this, well, maybe I can change his mind.
Yeah, let's hear it for
talking
the development
about that bit
of the objective. Yeah, I was just going to say, let's hear it for developing an objective consciousness and relieve ourselves of that self-centered perspective.
Right. I mean, you just that's the thing about just, you know, we were talking about that following his instructions issue. Unless you've supplied the favorable conditions, it's actually problematic to have an adjuster, not helpful.
Mm.
I mean, in terms of any sort of active engagement, I mean, yes, the adjuster will make a soul for you, and that's kind of handy, so you'll survive this life. But, in terms of following
there is that.
God's voice, quote-unquote, You know, you'll just be following your own voice if you haven't supplied the favorable conditions.
And you'll be feeling pretty good about it.
Oh, yeah. It'll be self-righteousness in a heartbeat. See, the adjuster's influence will make sure that it feels so profound that it couldn't be anything but righteousness in your mind. But, of course, it's self-righteousness.
Yeah.
He makes it worse. The adjuster's a double-edged sword.
Well, I've got a couple of references on this last sentence here, which is, very interesting. A new revelation is always contaminated by the older evolutionary beliefs. The authors of the papers come back to this a few times. I'll just give you a couple of them. One is on page 1626, just a short little thing here. It says, always does the socialized religion of a new revelation pay the price of compromise with the established forms and usages of the preceding religion which it seeks to salvage. Pretty much what was going on here with, Melchizedek brought something really advanced and was trying to salvage these primitive beliefs, and it paid the price. It compromised. The other one is a really interesting, almost a like a Zen koan, it strikes me as. It's way up in part four on page 2094. They're talking about the human mind and values. It's actually a moral choice, ethical choice, and religious choice. A nice little list there. And it says, thus it appears that all human progress is effected by a technique of conjoint revelational evolution. And that's in italics, revelational evolution.
Hmm.
So, they definitely send us these revelations either, through personalities or, in this case, this very unique case, a book. But they tell us, well, it's got to evolve. These revelations they're always ahead of the curve, out there at the point of the arrow, so to speak. Piercing the new truth, and the kind of back in the wake somewhere, it gets mixed in and creates this revelational evolution. Interesting term.
Yes, and that's a good point to bring in, James, so that people don't misinterpret what I was saying. I'm not saying that you can take delight in cultivating and make it so that there isn't evolution. And the issues that you're bringing up that are associated with that fact. At the beginning of the book, the revelators don't say that you can make it so that there's either distortion of meaning or not. They say that you have, the two options are more or less distortion of meaning. You want to take the light of cultivating so that there's less instead of more distortion of meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. All right. So that brings us up to section 8, which is, I'm going to go ahead and read it because it's a short one. And trivia note here, it's the second shortest section in the Urantia book.
Yeah.
There is one shorter. Trivia quiz.
And where is it? Oh, you're asking?
Well, does anybody know where it is?
Are you including the preface, section 0, as the one?
No.
Okay.
No. You're right. There are some very short little prefaces, which we've talked about before. Now I'll tell you. It's in paper 17. It's section 7, the Adjutant Mind Spirits. And it's basically, they list them, but then say the narration of the nature and functioning of the seven adjutant mind spheres belongs more appropriately to the story of your local universe of Nebadon. So it's sort of it's almost a parenthetical section there. Pretty short.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. Cool.
So, section 8, departure of Melchizedek. It was shortly after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that Machaventa decided to end his emergency bestowal on Urantia. Melchizedek's decision to terminate his sojourn in the flesh was influenced by numerous conditions, chief of which was the growing tendency of the surrounding tribes and even of his immediate associates to regard him as a demigod, to look upon him as a supernatural being, which indeed he was. But they were beginning to reverence him unduly and with a highly superstitious fear. In addition to these reasons, Melchizedek wanted to leave the scene of his earthly activities a sufficient length of time before Abraham's death to ensure that the truth of the one and only God would become strongly established in the minds of his followers. Accordingly, Machaventa retired one night to his tent at Salem, having said good night to his human companions, and when they went to call him in the morning, he was not there, for his fellows had taken him. I just love the way they phrase that.
His fellows had taken him.
Isn't that what a beautiful way. I mean, poetic, straightforward, yeah. But prosaic, too. It's just like, well, he was not there, for his fellows had taken him.
So his fellows that took him, was that the same fellows that made sure he incarnated? Or was that his...
Yeah.
I'm thinking it'd be the other receivers and the other receivers and maybe some of the team, you know, that put together the body for him. It's a team.
It did have a feel of his fellow receivers as you were reading it, but then I thought, wait, it's got to be those that set it all up, I would think.
Well, his fellows kind of leads you to think it might be Melchizedek's too.
Right. I mean, they're not really trying to invoke all of the machinery at that point. They're just trying to get you remember there's 11 fellow Melchizedeks and they're in charge and they took him, or they saw to it that he was demortalized. Therein lies a lot of mystery, but basically, you'll see later they're encouraging you to think a little bit more about the technology of it all. But that's this initial one. It's mostly just the other 11 Melchizedeks that they're wanting you to think of.
I thought it was interesting.
I mean, just one little thing. I mean, also for those who know the Bible, I mean, notice how they're paralleling Enoch's famous sentence in Genesis 5 there.
Yes.
And he was not, for God took him.
Hmm. Okay.
Right.
They're paralleling that. He was not, for his fellows had taken him. You see, they're paraphrasing the passage about Enoch there.
Now, do you have any reflection on his leaving unceremoniously without telling anybody? That seems awfully abrupt. And as we find out to come, Abraham was pretty dejected as a result. That's like, was there another way? I mean, could he have left a note? I don't know.
Well, he did prepare them. He kept telling me it was better. What, James? What?
A note on the refrigerator, of course.
Oh,
right. He's got one of those
in his tent.
Magnet, refrigerator magnet.
Now, if he had left a refrigerator magnet, that would have been something.
But I mean, what do you think? Seriously, I mean, prepare. Mm-hmm. He tried to prepare them, but you know, tonight's the night, guys. I'm taking off. I don't know. I don't know what he was thinking.
Well, you know, Jesus also told everyone many times that he would be leaving. They never let it sink in.
Never got it.
Unlike Melchizedek, apparently, you know, Jesus even was telling him right up to the moment, and it still didn't help with the transition.
Right.
Yeah,
so.
You know, you got to think that it would just it would really complicate things because, you know, what would be the first question? You know, well, I got to go. Where are you going?
Yeah.
Nowhere, actually. I'm going to still be standing here, you know, meddling in your affairs.
Exactly. That's what I mean. And that's even, like, talk about the superstition. It's like, whoa. He doesn't want to do that to these poor people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, James, because, yeah. You know why I said what I just said, because we're going to read about that shortly. You know,
yeah.
He can't give them any sense that there's these 12 Melchizedeks that are, you know, all over dabbling in human affairs. I mean, yeah, it's akin to, you know, not the revelators of the fifth epical revelation not telling us about the lower order of angels.
Right.
Because it would be akin to a betrayal of trust.
Right.
Yeah. Better to just bug out.
Well, you know, we're told how long he lived, and I thought it was interesting that they were very specific. It was shortly after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that he decided. Is there any thought on why that was thrown?
Well, think about, you know, we talked about it a little bit last time. What became of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in the minds of these highly superstitious, fearful people?
Oh,
right.
God.
Degenesis.
Yeah.
God destroyed it.
Right. So, I mean, it just, that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, I'm sure they just were, you know, going crazy with superstitious speculation. He's like, okay, I think it's time to take myself out of the picture here, because I'm not helping with this.
Well, and it says there they were beginning to reverence him unduly and with a highly superstitious fear. They even had were having a fear of him. And part of that, I get
his did he do it, you know? Did he destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, et cetera, you know, just so.
And he wasn't aging like everybody else either, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there certainly is that element. But then again, you know, there is precedence. Not like humans didn't have Van and Amadon for 150,000 years.
Yeah.
That would have been.
Not to mention that, you know, 300,000 years before that, but but in that sort of, you know, isolated situation where, you know, as Machaventa is here, you know, you had Van and Amadon for 150,000 years. And like you're saying, there's a number of reasons, but they try to, you know, the biggies. The biggie isn't that he wasn't aging as rapidly.
That's what I thought,
yeah.
Well, Miss Ann, you feel like taking over the reading?
Okay. We'll step on now. After Melchizedek's departure, it was a great trial for Abraham when Melchizedek so suddenly disappeared. Although he had fully warned his followers that he must sometime go as he had come, they were not reconciled to the loss of their wonderful leader. The great organization built up at Salem nearly disappeared, though the traditions of these days were what Moses built upon when he led the Hebrew slaves out of Egypt. And that's amazing that the organization there at Salem nearly disappeared after he left. That's just amazing.
Well, you know, we see the same thing today. You go into a third world area and you put together some structure, but the moment you go away and let go of it, it all just unravels. It
falls apart. Right.
Yep. Yep. The loss of Melchizedek produced a sadness in the heart of Abraham that he never fully overcame. Hebron he had abandoned when he gave up the ambition of building a material kingdom, and now upon the loss of his associate in the building of the spiritual kingdom, he departed from Salem, going south to live near his interest at Gerar. Well, that was part of the reason Abraham left also. So Abraham became fearful.
Yeah, I mean, before you, I mean, just so people know the geography, he's going further south down into the Negev, down into the desert in southern Palestine. Moving, you know, fairly definitively away from the Jerusalem area, you know, unlike Hebron.
Okay, yeah, it's good to clarify that. Abraham became fearful and timid immediately after the disappearance of Melchizedek. He withheld his identity upon arrival at Gerar so that Abimelech appropriated his wife. Shortly after his marriage to Sarah, Abraham one night had overheard a plot to murder him in order to get his brilliant wife. This dread became a terror to the otherwise brave and daring leader. All his life he feared that someone would kill him secretly in order to get Sarah. And this explains why on three separate occasions this brave man exhibited real cowardice. Now the biblical relating that is that God told him to, you know, there's no reference to his cowardice there.
We were bringing this up indirectly last time. So here you have one of the three with Abimelech. The other was back in Egypt, and now, even though the revelers point out that whole issue with his wife, we don't know exactly what transpired, but there was apparently something about along these lines with his fear, that transpired in Egypt as well. That didn't really derive the main elements of the story like the Bible would have you indicate. But here they're saying, but that doesn't mean that story, you know, is totally made up. There is this long-standing issue, this sort of Achilles heel that Abraham had with this, more than fear, even more than dread, just full-on terror that he possessed in this regard. So his judgment was just utterly, disarmed by this particular little, area of thought. And number three, we'll see in the next paragraph if people can't imagine what it probably is from having read Genesis.
But Abraham was not long to be deterred in his mission as the successor of Melchizedek. Soon he made converts among the Philistines and of
Abimelech's people.
Abimelech. I've overpracticed it, don't you think? And it's actually very simple when you think about it. Abimelech. Let me start that over. The Philistines and of Abimelech's people made a treaty with them and in turn became contaminated with many of their superstitions, particularly with their practice of sacrificing firstborn sons. Thus did Abraham again become a great leader in Palestine. He was held in reverence by all groups and honored by all kings. He was the spiritual leader of all the surrounding tribes, and his influence continued for some time after his death. During the closing years of his life, he once more returned to Hebron, the scene of his earlier activities and the place where he had worked in association with Melchizedek. Abraham's last act was to send trusty servants to the city of his brother, Nahor, on the border of Mesopotamia, to secure a woman of his own people as a wife for his son Isaac. It had long been the custom of Abraham's people to marry their cousins, and Abraham died confident in that faith in God which he had learned from Melchizedek in the banished schools of Salem.
Yeah, there's a, you know, some little tidbits in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we probably, you know, for those who are familiar with the Bible, you can see how they're tossing in little details of clarification about elements in the Bible story. You know, the closeness of relationship between, you know, it starts with the closeness of relationship between Abraham and Sarah, and this whole issue of, well, is she your sister or your wife? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
My half-sister. This whole bit about, there were a number of examples in the Bible where you have, you're coming down from two brothers, you'll have a son on one side marrying a granddaughter on the other side. That pattern. You know, it's in that sense of cousins. You know, not first cousins, but you know the general sense of the word cousin. In other words, a really close relationship, relation. You know, not literally brother or sister, but close.
You know, I hear people from the East still refer my cousin brother or my cousin sister. I had not heard that until I got to know people from that part of the world. And if someone is listening, they many times they just refer to them as their brother, and most people think, in this country would think, oh, they're brothers. But then you'll occasionally hear cousin brother real quick, you know. So that came on down in some of the cultures.
Or like we often do, when we say cousin, we mean first cousin.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's even more general than, you know, second cousins and second cousins first removed and all that sort of stuff. I mean, just, you know, the general historical foundation of the word cousin is doesn't have all those specific things, and that's why we created specific designations like first cousin to indicate a particular cousin in the relationship, you know, in the close relations.
You're talking to me. This paragraph is amazing how the Revelators do tie in a lot of scripture here in this one little paragraph. Because at times I thought, I wonder why. Well, they couldn't try to rewrite it all, right? That one sentence about him, he became contaminated with many of their superstitions, particularly with their practice of sacrificing firstborn sons. And in Genesis, what do we have? Abraham?
Ready to pull the trigger on Isaac, yeah.
Yeah, and see, this is that third instance that they were referring to in the previous paragraph. Remember when they say superstitions, you know, like the emphasis, like we were seeing them emphasizing, superstitious fears. And Abraham has this weak point relative to fear. So, you know, if he's immersed in this culture, you know, that believes in sacrificing firstborn sons, he's going to have a fear that if he doesn't follow that, they're going to kill him and take his wife.
Hmm. Wow, a double whammy. This is hard.
So,
she really must have been quite a brilliant gal for him to have that kind of fear. And I believe that's the word they use, the adjective, right? Brilliant.
Yeah.
See, so when you take it out of the false biblical context of God telling him to do these things.
Yes.
See, then you can see it's the third instance where, you know, he doesn't have the courage to stand up against this universal practice, you know, as barbarous or savage, I suppose we should really say savage as it is, a complete abomination. He doesn't have the courage because he's got this greatest of all fears that keeps playing in. Every time there's something, you know, where superstition is invoking fear, this weak spot comes in, this real cowardice, like they said.
That's why they
emphasize that, you know, like I said, it's not just fear, it's dread, it's not just dread, it's terror. I mean, you know, they're trying to point out this just trumps, so.
Faith and trust, yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, you can see, you know, that this is, this is a problem, you know, with really being able to take a hold of the trust and faith that Melchizedek wanted him to. He's always struggling with this Achilles heel.
Well, fear will do that to us. Fear will do that.
Yes, indeed.
Yep, so he gets into the magic and fear mode instead of the trust and faith mode.
Kind of like me reading a Bim. See, there I go. Abimelech. It's so simple. I've said it so many times in my life.
So many
references about these missionaries and all the work they're doing in the schools and everything, and then they tell us that, you know, by the time Abraham died, the schools had vanished in Salem.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
That's not a very long legacy for those things to hang on. I guess, you know, they were all missionaries and they split for parts around the world. It just seems kind of odd that there's nothing left at headquarters, you know.
Now that's why they said, see, that, you know, like Asia Minor, you know, around Lake Van, really, you know, rather than Salem, you know, it became Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Asia Minor were the Salem missionaries, you know, beyond the lives of Melchizedek and Abraham. That's really where that missionary effort was reaching out from, not from Salem.
Right. Well, and they've got, you know, of course, the Hebrew religion is going to end up being based there, but the Melchizedek schools are gone by that time.
Yeah, that's why, you know, it gets reborn, you know, a headquarters there gets reborn and as Jerusalem, you know, eventually. I mean, the Salem thing faded away. The memory was there so that when someone wanted to pick a holy spot again, they went back to the spot that Melchizedek pitched his tent. You know, but, it wasn't a contiguous center. It had to be reborn there, as it were.
You know, and when you think about this whole epical revelation, it's kind of an improvisation. We know it's an emergency. It didn't come down from on high. This was like the 12 Melchizedek receivers were basically looking for direction and told to figure it out themselves, and they come up and draw straws, and Machiavenna comes down and says, okay, I'll try it. So it's like it's an improvisation and a long shot at that. And yet the remnants and vestiges and residue and all that are just enough to get the Moses thing and the Hebrews and prepare enough for Michael to come. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, and like James was pointing out, it was enough that if you had a discerning eye, you could see the last vestiges of the truth of this revelation in all those other religions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, paper 131. certainly by the time you get to 1,000 years ago, it's very hard to discern, anything left of, the teachings of Melchizedek in those other religions. They were very astray. Give it another 1,000 years after Jesus.
It was hard for the next generation to comprehend the story of Melchizedek. Within 500 years, many regarded the whole narrative as a myth. Isaac held fairly well to the teachings of his father and nourished the gospel of the Salem colony. But it was harder for Jacob to grasp the significance of these traditions. Joseph was a firm believer in Melchizedek and was, largely because of this, regarded by his brothers as a dreamer. Joseph's honor in Egypt was chiefly due to the memory of his great-grandfather Abraham. Joseph was offered military command of the Egyptian armies, but being such a firm believer in the traditions of Melchizedek and the later teachings of Abraham and Isaac, he elected to serve as civil administrator, believing that he could thus better labor for the advancement of the kingdom of heaven.
There they go again.
Once again, a huge story in Genesis 37, I think, yeah.
So much for undoing all those great stories.
Fill it in.
Where's that coat?
Yes, and in the way they said there, he was considered a dreamer in the scriptures. Of course, that's a famous story. He was sold to the traders, right, as a slave.
By
his brother.
Right.
We just see the, how did it, when you read it, it's like, well, now logically, how could he have really gotten into such favor in Egypt? And it's like, well, chiefly due to the memory of his great grandfather.
Uh-huh.
Those little tidbits that they throw in. Anyone who knows the story, it's kind of hanging on with Isaac, but by the time you get to Jacob, it's starting to go very soap opera on you. and that's they're pointing out that's what's going on.
A huge soap opera there they covered in one paragraph.
With Jacob and Esau and all that, rigmarole. As we're going through these, these are great examples of how the relators don't, retell all those stories. They just give you the key little elements and then let you work your way through those stories and unravel them and rediscover the little threads of truth that might be there.
Right. They're not doing the hard work. They're providing all the keys and clues, but we've still got to go dig it out. Now this term kingdom of heaven, there's a question in the chat room about the last words of the paragraph. Did Melchizedek actually use that terminology, or did Abraham? Or is this in the larger context?
The Melchizedek author of this paper used that term.
right.
We're not told whether or not Melchizedek actually used that term. That's the way I understand it.
Go ahead. Well, it does keep the thread going here, the kingdom of heaven coming down through all the epical revelations for sure. So, as a pattern of speech, or figure of speech.
Yeah, and we're thinking about the details of the Old Testament, but they're wanting you to reflect on on the whole of the Christian Bible, and you know that contrast between the Old and the New Testaments, and how tightly tied Melchizedek, like we were talking about last time, is to Jesus in many ways, and you know, so they're trying to invoke that
right.
that close association between the third and fourth epical revelations.
Yeah.
The teaching of Melchizedek was full and replete, but the records of these days seemed impossible and fantastic to the later Hebrew priest, although many had some understanding of these transactions, at least up to the times of the in mass editing of the Old Testament records in Babylon. What the Old Testament records describe as conversations between Abraham and God were in reality conferences between Abraham and Melchizedek. Later scribes regarded the term Melchizedek as synonymous with God. The record of so many contacts of Abraham and Sarah with the angel of the Lord refers to their numerous visits with Melchizedek. The Hebrew narrative.
Before you go on,
yeah.
We can digest that a little bit. Help people to appreciate, who aren't familiar with the Bible, just how sweeping those two little paragraphs are. That whole bit about the 6th century B.C. when they were in exile in Babylon and they were reworking things. And, you know, we have a strong tendency as readers of the Urantia book to be very hard on those reworkers of history. You know, but notice what they said in the previous paragraph. Within 500 years after Melchizedek, many regarded the whole narrative as a myth.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you shouldn't be too hard on those priests and scribes that were reworking things. You know, many of them were sincere and thinking, well, okay, there really wasn't a Melchizedek. That's a myth. You know, and we've known it for ages. You know, let's state it directly. You know, it means he was interacting with God. It wasn't totally, you know, a sincere process like that, but you know, it wasn't wholly insincere either.
Careful there, Chris. We got a couple of pretty bad words coming up here at the bottom of this page.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I know.
That's why you're softening it. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Before you hit those passages that sort of burn in your mind, you know, don't forget what they've said before that. But they're pointing out there is, this is a long time. It's a long time from. From the 20th century B.C. to the 6th century B.C.
Yeah, that's a long time, yeah.
A long time. And and then another little important thing for those who study the Revelation, or for the 5th epical Revelation, they point out that sometimes in the Old Testament when it says the angel of the Lord, that's referring to a brilliant evening star actually visiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here they're like, but not these. They're saying that's examples again of Melchizedek.
The Hebrew narratives of Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph are far more reliable than those about Abraham, although they also contain many diversions from the facts, alterations made intentionally and unintentionally at the time of the compilation of these records by the Hebrew priest during the Babylonian captivity. Keturah was not a wife of Abraham. Like Hagar, she was merely a concubine. All of Abraham's property went to Isaac, the son of Sarah, the status wife. Abraham was not so old as the records indicate, and his wife was much younger. These ages were deliberately altered in order to provide for the subsequent alleged miraculous birth of Isaac.
Yeah. Again, because it's not religion if it isn't magic and fear.
Yeah. And I find it interesting they never mention in the Revelation about Ishmael, you know? I just have always thought that was kind of interesting. So.
Well, I mean, see, in passing there, yes, there was a Hagar. Yes, there was an Ishmael. And at times they just, in passing, let you recognize that, there's an element of fact in a certain passage in the Bible. You can work your way through it. You can figure out what is probably, of the order of this last sentence, were alterations so that you have magic in play, so that it's actually religion, quote unquote, instead of history. So again, even when you see that they're deliberately altering things, intentionally doing things like they say before that, if they're thinking, it's like, well, we want this to be a religious text, not a historical text.
Hmm.
We need to properly bring out the quote unquote religious elements, magic and fear.
Yeah.
The national ego of the Jews was tremendously depressed by the Babylonian captivity. In their reaction against national inferiority, they swung to the other extreme of national and racial egotism, in which they distorted and perverted their traditions with the view of exalting themselves above all races as the chosen people of God. And hence, they carefully edited all their records for the purpose of raising Abraham and their other national leaders high above all other persons, not excepting Melchizedek himself. The Hebrew scribes therefore destroyed every record of these momentous times which they could find, preserving only the narrative of the meeting of Abraham and Melchizedek after the Battle of Sidon, which they deemed reflected great honor upon Abraham.
So, you see, Anne, remember how we were talking about that? I mean, there were extant records, and even if they destroyed a lot of them, it's not that that long until you have the book of Hebrews being written.
Yeah.
So there was a knowledge of Melchizedek that was, less distorted and perverted, quote unquote, that fed into the book of Hebrews.
And thus, in losing sight of Melchizedek, they also lost sight of the teaching of this emergency son regarding the spiritual mission of the promised bestowal son. Lost sight of the nature of this mission so fully and completely that very few of their progeny were able or willing to recognize and receive Michael when he appeared on earth and in the flesh as Machaventa had foretold. But one of the writers of the book of Hebrews understood the mission of Melchizedek, for it is written, "This Melchizedek, priest of the Most High, was also King of Peace, without father, without mother, without pedigree, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like a son of God, he abides a priest continually." This writer designated Melchizedek as a type of the later bestowal of Michael, affirming that Jesus was a minister forever on the order of Melchizedek. While this comparison was not altogether fortunate, it was literally true that Christ did receive provisional title to Urantia upon the orders of the 12 Melchizedek receivers on duty at the time of his world bestowal. That scripture has been preached a lot, I will say.
And that scripture is?
Hebrews 7.
Chapter 7.
Hebrews 7, yeah. Yeah.
It was the first thing to come. I love the way they give you a way to take what's literally in the Bible and interpret it via, you know, almost with a pun. Well, it's instead of the order of Melchizedek, it's the orders of the 12 Melchizedeks.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny.
That's right. Yeah, on the orders.
Put the whole new twist
on it.
Oh,
that's cool. Chris, I missed that.
I mean, that's why they put that in quotes, you know. It's like, if you want to put something up on the orders of the 12 Melchizedek receivers, you could replace that little quote.
They have fun with us, don't they?
They'll appreciate you got that pun, Chris.
Okay. Yeah, we all know to this day, like they're saying, while this comparison was not altogether fortunate, that whole thing of really in many ways pointing out an element of truth that there is a closeness between the third and fourth epical revelations, between Melchizedek of Salem and Jesus of Nazareth. However, in the minds of ignorant humans, this has become a very confused and confusing notion that people have taken off in all kinds of directions.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I've heard it preached many different ways. Yeah.
Well, showing up here in the fifth is a nice redirecting revelation that should help serious readers.
But yeah, you know, it also is a huge challenge to those who have staked a lot on the idea of Melchizedek-like priests.
Yes.
You know, there's some strong words here. So, preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices are being directly assaulted here.
Hmm.
They're equal opportunity offenders in many ways here.
they don't let these scribes off too gently either.
James, you're going back to that, aren't you?
Well, you know, you got to look at the adjectives, at the descriptors they're using, and they're not very good. And you know, there was a point, and it wasn't to exalt the kingdom of heaven. It wasn't to further the covenant of faith in God. It was, you know, unfortunately, it was this chosen people thing. It was very much not religion or historical. You know, they erred on both of those accounts deliberately on the one, and you know, I don't know how you'd say religiously how they erred, but they definitely dropped the ball.
Yeah, I mean, they missed that whole second prong of Melchizedek's mission to prepare the way for the Lord. Was really dealt a serious blow by this.
Well, yeah, and it's almost a parenthetical that they dropped that in, you know, saying that, you know, very few of their progeny were able or willing. Interesting to use that, able or willing. You know, this, like Chris keeps reminding us, these longstanding prejudices got stuck in there real good.
Yeah, like I was pointing out when we were talking about the adjuster and the favorable conditions. I mean, they throw in that or willing. You know, you can take any goofy notion that you put in your head and you can grab a hold of it with your personality and absolutize it. You know, that's the willing. You know, you willed your mind against the truth. So yeah, and it's there's nothing that anyone, including Jesus standing right in front of you, there's nothing that anyone can do if you are willing. There's none so blind as those who will not see.
Yeah.
So if you've grabbed a hold of your blindness with your personality and absolutized it. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree with you completely, you know, James. I mean, the words are distorted and perverted. That's about as strong as you can make them. You know, when you look at it with your eye of spiritual idealism, it's pretty horrendous. But that's why I was, you know, saying you can look at it with the material pragmatism eye, and you can see that there are issues that you need to consider. It's not wholly a negative spiritual phenomenon. But it is indeed quite negative from a spiritual perspective.
Right. And I'm not trying to spin this up into anything at all anti-Semitic. That's not my intention either. It's just that they're very straightforward on these things. They tell it as it happened, and they talk about this national egotism. It was a fact, and it hurt them. It definitely hurt them as a race. Maybe it still hurts them today. I don't know. I'm not going to comment on that. But
yeah, I mean, and just you know, the way we've been talking here for the last half an hour or more, this is a great example of the difference between the fifth epical revelation and the third and the fourth.
Yeah.
You know, the fifth is not just a spiritual message. It takes on all other issues. So unless you're courageous, like I said, it is nothing but an equal opportunity offender. I mean,
problematic.
You know, it lays waste to every cherished idea that everyone on the planet has.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus tried and tried to make sure that his apostles wouldn't do anything even remotely like that because he wanted the pure spiritual message to go out. But Michael gave the revelators permission to change that with the fifth epical revelation. That limitation is not in play in the fifth. And they go right at everyone's cherished preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, you know, having to do with everything you can think of. Social issues, political issues, economic issues, scientific issues, all sorts of religious ideas, et cetera, et cetera. You know, takes the steamroller to them and says, okay, now that we've flattened all that out, let's build something anew. Behold, all things now
becoming new.
Can be becoming new.
Mm. Yeah.
Not just some things, like what Jesus and Machiavelli were trying to do. All things now.
Well, Kermit, you ready to take us into section 10? We'll see how. I think we'll be able to finish. We should.
Uh-huh. Okay, we do have a caller from Huntington Beach. This might be a good time to bring him in.
Okay.
I think he may just have a comment or two. Hello, Robert.
You guys
Robert.
Are there? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Hi,
we
Robert.
Can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Hey,
all right. Well, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Second of all, James, you have to go on YouTube and listen to the song God's Refrigerator. You're going to love it.
Oh, I love it already.
Oh, man, he did leave the refrigerator magnet? Oh, man.
There you go. I'm telling you. Now, thirdly, I want to thank you guys. You know, that should have been first, because you guys do a great job every week. Because we're listening. You may not think it, you know, you guys just bullshitting among yourselves, but we're listening. And we keep tabs on what's going on. And, you know, did you notice, I wanted to point out a parallel and see what you guys think about this. Actually, there was two of them. But the one that really struck me is I happened to go over Kermit's last night with, you know, my fellow Urantians, and we had a study group, and we were on the arrest and betrayal of Jesus. And the thing that specifically hit me, you know, and of course all of us, is Peter denied Christ five times, is what we counted. And he showed real cowardice in that fourth revelation. Now, you go back to the third revelation with Melchizedek, and you've got Abraham showing cowardice after he leaves. And it's like, wow, that's interesting, isn't it? The ones closest to God are the ones who can do the things, you know, the most reverse.
Good point.
Yeah. Interesting parallel.
Both times. There's a parallel.
Interesting.
Sure.
You know, but there's a lesson there too. And the third thing I wanted to point out was the firstborn son sacrifice, that being substituted by, through Moses supposedly to the animal sacrifice, and then Paul twisting the whole thing that Jesus is the ultimate sacrifice. The substitution is what our civilization moved along.
Yeah.
Yeah, the compromises.
Exactly. I don't know if you noticed that, but that's what I noticed. And I thought, wow, that's insane. Look at how it's growing, how civilization is, if you want to call it growing, but evolving.
We progress in spite of ourselves.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, and the common thread through it all is the animal origin human beings that inhabit the planet. Yeah. Common thread.
Mm-hmm. Bingo.
Well, we got that revelational evolution going on.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for your insights, your correlation, and most of all, your encouragement, Robert. Thank you.
I love you guys. Fun.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Not to mention a little humor thrown in.
Yeah, well, I love the humor. That's right.
God bless, Roberto.
Okay. Catch you later. Bye.
Thanks, Robert.
Bye.
You're welcome.
That's probably a good thing to remind everyone of. You know, we were just focusing on the one element of the firstborn sacrifice, but you know, as you can clearly recognize from the Bible, you know, that seemingly horrendous story serves a very important purpose, a very strong challenge to transition from human sacrifice to animal sacrifice as a step forward. You know, so, you know, you notice that Robert was pointing out, humans in all of their seemingly random wanderings through thought space, nonetheless, over the course of evolution, you see how everything works toward good. Abraham has this Achilles heel, and he ends up almost killing Isaac because of his all-pervasive fear. However, you know, it really helped with that transition away from human sacrifice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet the sacrificial theme plays through, attitude plays through, so that Paul makes a brave attempt to end the sacrificial line by making Jesus the final sacrifice, and so it's progress. It is progress, even if it creates some additional problems down the line. It still moves things forward.
Yeah, because not only you know, like you were saying, it was progress in the sense he was trying to definitively put an end to sacrifice, but in order to do it, he really hearkened back to human sacrifice.
Right. Right.
Sacrificing Jesus. So,
right.
It's a double-edged effort. But that's the way it is in this very unguided evolutionary mix of a world that we have, you know, because we don't have visible, tangible individuals here to help us directly with these issues. They have to play out through the long, circuitous, mostly unguided evolutionary process, at least guided in the immediate sense. It's obviously guided in the higher sense, but definitely the longer process in the spectrum of evolutionary possibilities.
Definitely the hard way. Yeah. Okay, let's find out about the present status of Mac Event to Melchizedek.
Yeah, and I
during
suppose,
the years,
if we don't finish this, we'll pick up the rest of it next time here.
That's a fairly long section.
Yeah,
because
it is
okay.
Pretty long.
During the years of Machaventa's incarnation, the Urantia Melchizedek receivers functioned as 11. When Machaventa considered that his mission as an emergency son was finished, he signalized this fact to his 11 associates, and they immediately made ready the technique whereby he was to be released from the flesh and safely restored to his original Melchizedek status. And on the third day after his disappearance from Salem, he appeared among his 11 fellows of the Urantia assignment and resumed his interrupted career as one of the planetary receivers of 606 of Satania.
Well, that steps back to the fellows back there when I was reading.
Right. Yeah.
Right,
see, so that's what I was trying to point out. The fellows directly is pointing to the Melchizedek. But this is what I was referring to. See, this paragraph, they want you to start to reflect on the technique, all these details and all the mystery of that. What does it mean to demortalize him here, to release him from the flesh? See, and you notice the difference. It's how different it is from what we talked about, the normal morphing that a Melchizedek can do to make himself physically visible. He's not, he's obviously not just morphing back in any way. They're somehow, pulling him out. They're releasing him from that, and there's a body left behind that they have to do something with, and so it's not unlike them having to do something with Jesus's body.
Right.
Yeah. So they want you to just stop here and let go of the higher issues and just think about these technical details for a second and. Ponder and marvel at exactly what kind of technology is involved here.
Pretty high tech.
Yeah, very high tech, and it brings in that whole issue of his soul, infusing into his Melchizedek spirit and nature. Once they break the linkage with the body, this mortal body, and exactly how does that work?
And here's that third day thing again.
I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, and you got the third day always, and all the mystery of that. And,
Machaventa terminated his bestowal as a creature of flesh and blood just as suddenly and unceremoniously as he had begun it. Neither his appearance nor departure were accompanied by any unusual announcement or demonstration. Neither resurrection roll call nor ending of planetary dispensation marked his appearance on Urantia. His was an emergency bestowal. But Machaventa did not end his sojourn in the flesh of human beings until he had been duly released by the Father Melchizedek and had been informed that his emergency pistol had received the approval of the chief executive of Nevadon, Gabriel of Salvington.
Now that,
that's
notice how that, see how that ties into what we were talking about before. It's, you know, it's not a totally, improvised effort. You know, ad hoc, totally. I mean, yes and no. You know, they got approval, and those on high are tuned in to the phenomenon here.
Sure, sure.
Now, how exactly all this word gets back and forth?
What?
They don't explain.
That's,
I mean,
that's right. We don't have an archangel circuit yet, do we?
No, and. You know, so I guess we have, you know,
Melchizedek
individuals coming and going or something, you know.
Wouldn't you think the Melchizedeks can, they could communicate with each other, and especially Father Melchizedek and Gabriel?
Well, I mean, Machiavelli can communicate to this the 11, but the 12 Melchizedeks on the planet can't magically somehow talk to Father Melchizedek on
okay.
Salvington or something.
I'm just wondering if maybe the mountain had to ask.
You think they had a hotline to Dad?
there's no indication that you have some, you know, fancy transcendent linkage like that. You know, like say the way a creator son is always in touch with the eternal son.
Right.
You know, or a magisterial son. So you're left to just speculate. They would have had there have been some logistics here. They would have to, get the word so they couldn't just, you know, have all this happen, you know, in 5 minutes' time. But you've got a 94, isn't it, right? 94-year, probably towards the latter part of that, you know, there's this whole, well, I guess it's time to start, you know, ramping things down here.
Winding things up. Machiavenna Melchizedek continued to take a great interest in the affairs of the descendants of those men who had believed in his teachings when he was in the flesh. But the progeny of Abraham through Isaac, as intermarried with the Kenites, were the only line which long continued to nourish any clear concept of the Salem teachings. This same Melchizedek continued to collaborate throughout the 19 succeeding centuries with the many prophets and seers, thus endeavoring to keep alive the truths of Salem until the fullness of the time for Michael's appearance on earth.
Now
that's pretty
look at
amazing
the contrast
there.
Yeah, go ahead and comment, Kermit.
Well, just this, that Melchizedek continued to collaborate. So he's like talking to all the prophets of old, Isaiah and Daniel and all those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like collaborating.
Collaborating, yeah, it's a pretty strong word.
That's a two-way street.
Yeah.
Collaborate, yeah. Hey, there's a direct reference to this. Yeah, I think I'd like to read it. It's in the next paper.
Where is it, James?
It's in the next paper, 94.
Oh, okay.
It's a really, one of the most striking little references in the book really get your attention, especially when you pair it up with what we just read there, that little paragraph. Just up ahead here, a few pages on page 1033, they're talking about this is the Melchizedek teachings in the Orient, and they make mention of many of these different prophets they're talking about. Section 6 is titled Lao Tse and Confucius. And here's what they say. About 600 years before the arrival of Michael, it seemed to Melchizedek long since departed from the flesh, that the purity of his teaching on earth was being unduly jeopardized by general absorption into the older Urantia beliefs. It appeared for a time that his mission as a forerunner of Michael might be in danger of failing. And in the 6th century before Christ, through an unusual coordination of spiritual agencies, not all of which are understood even by the planetary supervisors, Urantia witnessed a most unusual presentation of manifold religious truth. Through the agency of several human teachers, the Salem Gospel was restated and revitalized, and as it was then presented, much has persisted to the times of this writing. It says, this unique century of spiritual progress was characterized by great religious, moral, and philosophic teachers all over the civilized world. And then it says, in China, two of these outstanding teachers were Lao Tse and Confucius. On the next page, it also talks about Gautama Siddhartha. Also, coincidentally, in the 6th century...
You read the word unique, and it was unique to that time. It was preparing the way. So it's very important to note that.
Yeah. Well, it's... They spell it out here. You know, we're a hard planet. You know, 500 years after Melchizedek, it was already turned into myth. Like Chris was saying, you know, these two millenniums, or 2000 BC to 600 BC, a lot had happened. A lot had not happened. And but this, I just love, the implications of this unusual coordination of spiritual agencies, not all of which are understood even by the planetary supervisors. So you've got Machaventa having quite a free hand here, doing some pretty amazing things. And to bring it forward, we've got to think about what he might be doing this very day and what he might have been doing in preparation for the 5th epical revelation.
So in these prophets and seers that we read in the Old Testament, where God calls them, a number of them are somewhat reluctant, and God basically really inveigles them to do what they're supposed to do. This little paragraph would imply perhaps that God here, the Lord, was in fact Melchizedek working these guys and cultivating them and giving them assignments that they weren't necessarily all that eager to take.
Yeah, back in paper 93 here, on those two paragraphs you read, I wanted to stress, this is a stark contrast to us, getting down on those who are reworking history in the 6th century BC and putting together, the Old Testament. You say, wow, it's all just a fairy tale. Well, no, not quite. Here's the contrasting statement. It's like, all those prophets and stuff, so-called prophets and seers, well, some of those prophets very much were prophets. I mean, they were literally being engaged by spiritual beings. They were indeed prophets. They weren't just seers. There was collaboration.
Yeah.
It forces you to, develop the intuition to discriminate between the true and the false stories in the Bible. You can't just do it the easy way and believe everything unconditionally or throw it all out unconditionally.
Exactly.
You have to sort through it. And not only Machaventa, but the name Malavatia points to how he was also part of this collaboration. The Melchizedeks were engaging, humans very directly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I think they still are.
Well,
very
they're
likely.
Not.
Very likely.
Are they as involved now?
Well, they're not here, but
right.
as we'll read next
again.
Time, we have only 20 seconds left here in the broadcast, but as we'll read next time, you know, Machaventa has been here.
Yes, yes.
That's right.
What? 1,000, yeah. Okay, guys.
Okay,
are we
gang.
Down to 40 seconds? My timer is
no,
off
less
here.
Than 10.
Yep.
Less
Bye.
Than 10.
Bye
God bless
now,
everybody.
Folks. God bless.
Hey, great study. Good night, everybody. Love y'all.
Good night now.